From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. If you've been downloading music for free online, the recording industry had a little message for you this week. You may be sued. Hundreds of lawsuits launched this week against ordinary music downloaders have signaled a shift in big music's strategy to regain control in the digital age. The attempt to scare file sharers straight hasn't attracted the best PR, but when an industry is losing an estimated $700 million a year to the web, it may be the only PR it can afford. Proponents of file sharing claim that the music industry as we know it has failed in every way and will be stripped of control by a new world it cannot understand. The industry says file sharing is just plain stealing, and it is on the warpath. Tonight on Point, The Empire Strikes Back, online file sharing, and the future of digital music. Are you running scared from the music industry's online offensive? Can the music industry battle back and win? Or has it been left in the dust? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Rick Carr, cultural correspondent for National Public Radio. Good evening and welcome, Rick Carr.
Tom, it's a pleasure to be with you.
It's great to have you. Also with me in the studio tonight is On Point News analyst Randall Kennedy, professor of law at Harvard Law School. Good evening, Randall Kennedy.
Thanks so much.
Good to have you. Rick Carr, take us in just to this past week for starters. Everybody's head turned when these numbers came out. Hundreds, 261, I guess, in total of file sharers who have had suits slapped on them. Who's being sued, Rick? What's it for? For how much money? Give us a picture of what's going on.
Well, there are 260 of them left as far as we know right now because, of course, there was one settlement this week, a 12-year-old girl who got slapped with one of the suits here in New York City.
Was that an oops or did they mean to pick out Brianna Lahara?
It's a little hard to tell whether it's an oops or not. The Recording Industry Association of America makes it sound like they don't know who these people are. And, of course, the information that they'd be getting from the Internet service providers wouldn't necessarily indicate how old these people are.
Okay.
It would just indicate what their names are.
So one 12-year-old off the table, but 260 others out there. Who are they? Who are they targeting?
Well, they're actually people who were uploading music, not necessarily people who are downloading music. They're looking for people with collections of 1,000 or more songs, it seems, that they were allowing others to take. And what they're looking at here is anywhere up to $150,000 per song. So if you're talking 1,000 songs, do the math. You're talking $150 million in potential liability.
Now, there's a little trail of precedent here already. Do they really go for that $150 million, or are they settling for $15? What's it look like?
No, they're not. I mean, with the girl here in New York City, they settled with her for $2,000. Some of the students, some of the university students they've gotten to so far, they've settled, you know, $10,000, $12,000, $7,000 to $15,000, somewhere in that range.
But enough to get your attention. I want to confirm just on the technology side here, because my guess is that there are many people out there who don't even know how many songs they've downloaded. They may have 1,000 plus and not even have counted them up. But does everyone who's swapping files online, whether it's with Kazaa or Grokster or whatever service, is everyone also uploading automatically if you have the software or not?
If you're not careful with the way the software is set up, absolutely. Some of the, especially the programs that run in the Microsoft Windows environment, they make your MP3 files available 24/7 if your computer's connected to the Internet. So you have to be very careful in the way you set it up if you don't want to share your collection and make sure that you've blocked that.
You may be an uploader, which means you may be a target. I guess the first question, Rick, is this got a lot of attention this week, lots of ink all over the place. Is your sense from the music industry that it's made its point, or does it have another 200, another 2,000 suits waiting in the wings?
You know, I think that the situation in the music industry right now is in such a state of flux that it's really hard to know what's going to happen. It's certainly the case that the Recording Industry Association of America is saying there's more to come. They're going to aggressively pursue this. I had someone in the music industry tell me earlier this week, look, it's in their interest to have this on NPR every week because they want to get the message out.
Be afraid. Be very afraid.
Well, yeah. And I spoke to some students at New York University last week, some of whom said they hadn't even heard about this over the summer. Others said, it doesn't apply to me. It only applies to people who have tens of thousands of songs. So it seems as though in the PR campaign, it is in the interest of the Recording Industry Association to sort of keep the pressure up.
And it's making some kind of impact. I mean, Billboard magazine has a story here saying incoming freshmen at colleges across the United States are getting a primer this month on the legal ramifications of file sharing. I mean, they're raising red flags.
Yeah, some of them have been, and that, you know, what a lot of the students at NYU were telling me last week was, well, what they're going to do now is they're just going to go and raid their friends' CD collections and burn copies of them. So it's not like they're going to get less free music. They're just not going to do it over the internet with strangers.
So always a workaround. They're saying, we want to get to the strategy that's at work here, but there's a practical question. Let's just hit it right here at the top, Rick, if we may. If people want to avoid this risk, and I guess at this point it's still a very small risk. I mean, it is 261, but that's a tiny number. How many file shares are there out there?
Nobody really knows. Millions, tens of millions,
okay,
certainly.
Okay, lots. But let's say you want to be very careful. You don't want to be to get a fat envelope from the Recording Industry Association of America or whoever's sending them out. What do you have to do to wipe your trail clean?
Well, I mean, you know, what the recording industry would like you to do is download one of their amnesty forms and sign up for the amnesty that they've set up, which says that you will delete and destroy the MP3 files that you downloaded, that you will destroy any CDs that you burned of that music, and that you will promise never to do it again. And I believe there's another term in there that says you also have to delete the file sharing software that you have. You know, there are other ways of doing it. There are other workarounds. There are pieces of software that you can use now that are promising guaranteed anonymity. So there are any of a number of different ways you can go if you don't want the process server to show up at your door.
If you just go to your computer, you know, take the Kazaa icon and dump it in the trash, are you finished or is it still sitting on your hard drive? Can you still be traced?
You know, if the vast majority of people are Microsoft Windows users, I am not. I am a Macintosh and Linux user,
okay.
So I don't actually know the answer to that.
Okay. Mysteries of the universe. But I guess what I'm hearing and reading is that it's not necessarily that simple, that it can be deep in the hard drive and you've got some deep swabbing up to do if you really
absolutely
want to be rid of it.
And that's, you know, that's part of the nature of working in the Microsoft environment. These programs kind of winnow their way into your operating system and can keep doing things if you don't know about it. I mean, one of the things that students at NYU were complaining about was the fact that some of these peer-to-peer file trading programs crash their computer a lot. It's not the software itself that's doing it. It's a lot of the other stuff that piggybacks with it, mm-hmm, spyware and whatnot, that's keeping track of what you're doing for some commercial third party who wants to know what you're doing with your computer.
Okay, question first on the culture side. Rick Carr, you follow it. Do you think that this is going to knock those millions of file sharers out of the saddle, or is this, spitting in the wind?
One word answer. It's no. It's not going to get these people offline. Look, I mean, the music industry has a very strange relationship with the peer-to-peer networks. There's a company down in Atlanta called Big Champagne, which tracks the traffic on these peer-to-peer networks. There are a couple other companies that do the same thing. The major record labels have contracts with these companies. They want to know what the kids are sharing.
So it's a market research tool, but it's also draining. We read something like $700 million a year out of their coffers, record sales down 25-26% just in the last couple of years.
Let's go through some of those numbers. Record sales, not necessarily down that much. Record shipments are down. Some of that may have to do with better just-in-time inventory control in the recording industry. And in terms of down $700 million on account of file sharing, we don't know that for sure. I mean, if you look at the United Kingdom right now. So far this year, record sales are up about 2% in the United Kingdom. Everyone I know in the UK has a peer-to-peer program on their computer. The use of, you know, file trading over there is every bit as rampant as it is in this country, and yet record sales are up.
But it looks like the American industry is absolutely desperate to stop it. If it's not hurting them and hurting them badly, why such a push?
You know, this is something that in the 4 years that I've been covering this dispute in the industry, the analogy people keep coming back to is the buggy whip manufacturers at the end of the 19th century didn't like it when those horseless carriages came along either. And I think that what's happening here is we are near the, to use the overused phrase, the tipping point in the music industry right now. What's happening is that they're just trying to buy some time, because there's another big piece of news in the past 2 weeks in the record industry, which is that Universal, the largest group of major labels in the world, almost 30% market share in the United States, has announced that it wants to cut the price of CDs by about 30%.
Meaning, if you file share, we're coming after you, or at least we want you to fear that we may, but if you go out and buy a CD, it's going to cost you $9 instead of $12, $13, $14?
Yeah, maybe as little as that, or the list price is now around $18. They want to try to get that down to $13. They want to try to buy some time, get people back into the record stores, because what's happening at the end of this year, there's a lot of hoo-ha earlier this year about Apple coming online with the iTunes Music Store and having a huge amount of success. They just sold 10 million downloads of music, 99 cents a song, $10 an album. So far, it looks to be a huge success. What is happening is as we get closer to the end of the year, we're going to see many, many more of these online music stores coming up, usable by people who run the Microsoft Windows platform, which, of course, is the vast majority of computer users. So it looks like right now what the industry is trying to do is buy some time and see how those things work.
And buy some time until they can get people paying. Till they are bringing in money from the online's not going away, but they're going to start getting their commercial taproot into the online. And in the meantime, they're kind of, pulling on the reins here to say, hey, remember, this is a business. Commerce is involved. Be a little bit afraid so that people are ready to pay when their services come on.
Yeah, but look at what happens with these services so far. I mean, we already have something of a price war going on with online music. Apple at 99 cents a song, buymusic.com at 79 cents a song. A lot of the informed opinion in the industry says we're headed for a price war with online music that's going to take us to about 50 cents a song, $5 an album. It's like going back to 1973 or something like that, okay?
Back to the 70s. Sounds like a radio show.
And what's going to happen, I think, is that the hard merchandise, the CDs themselves, are going to have to match that. The prices are going to have to keep going down in order to keep people coming into the stores. Or, as an analyst told me earlier this week, that or the CD is going to have to offer you a lot more than you can get online.
What a picture. The video and maybe donuts will pop out as well. Randall Kennedy, what a picture here. A great big industry feeling very threatened by technology, but then along with that technology, a vast change in popular behavior, and popular behavior that crosses the line right into illegality. I mean, it is, everybody agrees, I guess, it's copyright infringement, but yet millions and millions and millions of people doing it and not feeling any apparent guilt about it.
True enough. This must be an industry that feels awfully bad to want to risk putting such a bad taste in the mouth of future clients, future consumers, especially consumers who are probably among the most passionate music listeners.
Yeah.
So they must feel that they're under a lot of pressure. They are trying to scare people instead of trying to attract people. They're trying to attract people, too, through cheapening their product. But they're going around now, this week, as the police. And that doesn't bode well for an industry, policing people, scaring people. That doesn't suggest a good strategy to me over the long run.
Interesting in legal terms. I mean, if you look back to the Prohibition, you could bust up all the moonshine stills you wanted, and yet they kept producing moonshine.
Yeah, especially in this society with this technology, young people. It seems to me that the industry also has to be careful because some of the people who were behind the competition seem to have a sort of anti-industry ideology working. It's not just commerce. It's the idea that these old fuddy-duddies are behind the time and they're sticking it to them.
And that they don't deserve to own the industry anymore.
They don't deserve to own the industry. It's sort of like some of the people that go after Microsoft in a certain sort of way. It's not just dollars and cents. There's some sort of cultural struggle going on here as well.
We're going to get into that as well. But Rick Carr, I guess a bottom line question, do you think that the industry at this point can regain its kingdom?
No. I think that go back to like the late 1920s and early 1930s. At that point, the record industry went through a 95% sales decline because there was this great new piece of technology that brought you music for free into your home. It was called radio. Okay. And the industry had to figure out how to play ball with radio. This is the same thing that we're seeing happen here. This happens time and again in the music industry. A new piece of technology comes along. The industry, as it's established, is averse to change. It doesn't like it. It doesn't want to play along, but it ultimately has to.
And may be reshaped by the time it gets to the other side of the big shift. Rick Carr, Randall Kennedy, stand by. We're talking tonight about online music sharing and the empire, the music industry, striking back. Are you running scared from the music industry's online offensive? Are you afraid of being sued? Can the music industry battle back and win? Or has it been left in the dust? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about online music sharing and the empire, the music industry striking back. You can join the conversation. Have you wiped Kazaa, Grokster, Streamcast off your hard drive this week? Can the music industry scare the online music swapping world back into line, into legality? If CDs are made cheaper, will you buy again? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight by Rick Carr, NPR correspondent for all things cultural. In the studio with me tonight, Randall Kennedy, On Point news analyst. We're joined now from Nashville, Tennessee, by Wayne Russo, president of Grokster, one of the world's most heavily trafficked file-sharing companies. When he last looked, there were about 750 million files being shared as he looked over across his shoulder. Wayne Russo, thanks very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Tom. And before we get started, let me just say that Randall and Rick, I was listening in. Boy, they were just hitting all cylinders. They were so right on, I can't even begin to tell you. And secondly, please, you know, I want you to modify your last statement, though, your earlier statement, and please tell everybody if they take Kazaa or Streamcast off their computer, please put Grokster on it instead.
Okay, we're pushing the business at every moment. We take that. We're going to hear more, Wayne, but let me introduce also Thomas Dolby Robertson. He joins us from San Mateo, California. He's a Grammy-nominated electronic music artist, hit songs like She Blinded Me with Science and Hyperactive, founder of Beatnik, a digital audio company, a pioneer in digital music distribution. Thomas Dolby Robertson, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Great. Let me turn to you first, if I may. You were one of the first people to talk about using the web to distribute music. This is back in the 90s, deep in the 90s. Did you imagine then that people would be doing it for free?
Absolutely. And you know, although I'm blue in the face from talking about this stuff for the last 10 years, I think I actually started in 93, my position on it has not really changed. And yet I've gone from being a kind of a bad boy to being a relative conservative.
What made you bad, Thomas? What makes you conservative now,
well,
at least in interpretation?
As Rick Carr very aptly pointed out, the music business is not very much in the habit of changing. Doesn't like to change, but every now and then a disruptive technology, like he mentioned in the 20s with radio, came along.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the 1920s. That was nearly a century ago. They've had several decades now of coursing along very comfortably, locked into a very favorable business advantage.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that is that the only way, when I started in the music industry, to distribute music was by pressing out pieces of plastic and putting them in stores.
But that made money for you as an artist, you personally.
Absolutely. But, you know, as far as the few companies, the six or so companies that did that, they were the only game in town because it's very hard to have fleets of trucks and pressing plants and stuff. And now along has come this disruptive technology which suddenly turns the whole thing on its head.
And requires no fleets of trucks.
Exactly. In fact, those things are a disadvantage, especially if you're the CEO of some public record label that is trying to make your numbers look good from quarter to quarter. So I completely agree with Rick that what you're seeing here is an effort to put the brakes on and just slow down and give themselves a little bit of breathing space before the inevitable happens. And what's inevitable is that we go from this analog music model to a solely digital one.
Wayne Russo, do you think that the music industry can dive into this digital era and win? Is it going to continue to hold the reins of musical arts in the United States, in the world?
No. The genie is definitely out of the bottle, and in fact, Thomas is living proof of that. He's an artist that I'm sure didn't have the best experiences with these, at the time, six, now five major record labels. And since then, things have only gotten worse. And by the way, just an adjunct here, there was also one little brouhaha about 20 years ago. It wasn't just radio. There was a little thing called a dual cassette machine.
Mm-hmm.
And
clumsier, though, than the web.
True. But if you'll recall, Thomas, at that time, 20 years ago, the industry was yelling and screaming that the sky was falling.
Mm-hmm.
That they were the blank audio cassette would put them completely out of business. Well, unfortunately, it didn't.
But the internet's got such capacity. When our producer talked with you earlier, Wayne Ross, so as I understand, there were literally 750 million files being shared on your Grokster, Mr. President. That's a little different than mailing an occasional cassette, to your cousin in Akron.
Well, that's absolutely correct. And by the way, it's going to get a lot worse. I'm sure Thomas will agree with me too. Very, very, very soon, internet providers will leap from the Earth links and your local cable company to the power companies, the utility companies, who already have your house wired.
And so music will be flowing in from every outlet. Thomas Dolby Robertson, what's your view? Does the music industry have a shot at regaining the driver's seat here? Does it deserve the driver's seat? I guess Randall Kennedy raised this issue, but, it's been slow on the technology. There have been complaints from artists for years about how they've been treated by the music industry, the amount of money that actually ended up in their pocket. What should, as a national community, what should we root for here?
Yeah, I don't think they can keep a grip on it. And I think that there will always be intermediaries, but I think they're going to have to evolve and morph very quickly. And the lock that they've had on this for decades is very fast slipping away. So they have no God-given right to be the ones that get to filter what music the fans get to hear. But in a lot of ways, you have to remember that although, it's breaking our hearts how much money they're losing, this is really about music. It's about music fans, and it's about musicians. And I think that people very often don't see the wood for the trees. The implications of this new technology for the music fan and for the lifestyles that we musicians lead is very, very good. And I think it can only get better from that point of view.
Fill in that picture. Is the web going to support stretch limos and rhinestone high heels?
Unfortunately, there were thousands of people very comfortably employed in the middle of that whole supply chain all of that time. And a lot of that is going to go away because it's so efficient to just share a digital file or download, a 99-cent song from iTunes. It's just a much, much more efficient way to do things. And unfortunately, a lot of those guys that used to get employed there are going to be out of a job.
But what about the musicians? I mean, our image, and of course it comes from the ones who win the big sweepstakes, who gained great fame, but is of people really living the highest of high lives. Can that be supported? Will that be supported by a digitally based music world?
Can I jump in here for a second?
Well, let me hear from Thomas just first, then
okay.
I'll get you, Wayne.
Yeah. Well, it's very possible that the star system that we've been accustomed to is also going to start to fizzle a little bit. Because I think that the ability of big business to put a poster of a pop star in every store window, and every time you turn on the radio, there he is, and MTV and so on, I think it's going to become a lot more diversified. So I think that possibly the era, the sort of golden era of the megastar may be somewhat behind us. But, many industries have a cadence like this. Hollywood is not what it was. Jazz music is not what it was. These things do go through dynamics, and they go through a rise and fall. We're possibly on the tail end of the sort of pop music star system.
And Wayne Russell, what's your vision of what the industry, more than that, the music that's available and the rewards to artists will look like in a digital era?
Oh, my gosh. Well, first of all, I wanted to jump in there. I'm sorry for interrupting, Thomas and Tom, but it's really interesting. Here's what I think is going to happen. I think that that file sharing and the internet will lead to a musical explosion. What's going to happen, I feel, is that music artists, independent artists especially, there are going to be many, 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 many niche artists. They're going to be giving their music away, or in the case of a Thomas Dolby, perhaps Thomas Dolby's music will be brought to you by Snapple. Furthermore, what this means
yes,
is
that's up to him in some degree.
Don't
okay.
Please.
Well, I'm using an example there, Thomas. I know you're a Coca-Cola drinker, but
you're saying sponsored, actually wired up with I don't know, this kind of an endorsement business.
Well, that's one thing, but you see, here's the net. And this is something that many artists have lost sight of. The only way you're going to build a career, sustain it, and really make your money, and where your real income comes from if you're an artist, is to go out and perform live. That's the bottom line.
So gain your fame, gain your distribution online, make your money in the arena or the coffee house.
That's the way it works now. I'll give you a very good example. Robbie Williams. You've never heard of him here in the U.S. Thomas, you've heard of him, correct?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. He is arguably the biggest pop star in the world. Not heard of in the U.S., but humongous. Now, he just played an event, an annual event in the U.K., one of the big festivals called Nebworth. He sold 125,000 tickets a night, three nights in a row, at 30 pound sterling each.
Well, that'll stretch your limo for a while. Rick Carr, I want to bring you back in here. You're watching all this for NPR. How do the interests play out? You hear how Thomas Dolby Robertson and Wayne Russo at Grokster are describing the future. Does this add up to you? Does it sound realistic? And are the interests who are in place now, I would say entrenched, except they've sort of been popped out of their trenches, do they just have to live with this? Can you imagine it turning the whole industry and the lives of musicians, even the kind of music that we hear, on its head?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I had a really interesting conversation early last year with a guy named Roger Lynn, who invented the first programmable drum machine back in the late 1970s. He also is a platinum songwriter for Eric Clapton. He said, we're going to look back on the 20th century as being this weird aberration where music became an industry that made stuff, made physical things and put it into stores. Mm-hmm. We're kind of moving in this direction now. I mean, it is for free. You can go and download a piece of software called Pro Tools, which will give you a lot of the capabilities of a professional recording studio on your PC.
Mm-hmm.
Kids are coming into universities now already knowing how to make music the way that the pros do. I mean, in a way, it's like it's kind of like going back to folk music where everybody used to know how to play a guitar or a banjo or the piano or something like that.
It's true. It seems like every other kid in my neighborhood is a CD-pressed musician now. They've made
absolutely,
their own.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, the people's passion for music isn't going to go away. The other sort of like, you know, sort of phrase I want to drop in here is there's a musician here in New York, a guy who calls himself Momus. And he's twisted Andy Warhol's metaphor, and he says, in the future, everyone will be famous to 15 people. And maybe that's what we're looking at here, is a world in which people are making music for each other for the love of it. And absolutely, I mean, the idea that playing live is the way the musicians get rich, that's always been the way it's been. I mean, I've just been reading a biography of the late Keith Moon of The Who. You know, they made almost no money off the records. Even the multi-platinum Who's Next record, they made almost no money off of. When they made money was when they would go out and play in stadiums and sell 50,000 tickets a night.
So the Suits in Burbank made a lot of money, but it wasn't necessarily going to The Who.
Well, let's go back to the early days of the internet boom, where there was this word floating around a lot in a lot of industries, disintermediation.
Yeah.
You cut out the intermediaries. Now, that's kind of become a dirty word in the wake of the dot-com crash, but that's precisely what's going on in the music industry with the corner offices who are losing out.
But what about the artists? I mean, we're hearing a fairly receptive tone here tonight, but we have heard artists go on the record and absolutely bemoan this. How does the world of artists break down, Rick? What do you hear from them? What percentage are saying, yeah, let's go with this new thing, and what percentage are saying, how the heck am I going to make a living?
I don't think
or the living
percentage
to which I'm accustomed.
Right, yeah. I think it's a class issue. It's not a percentage issue. If you are on a major label right now and you're happy with your major label deal, let's say you're a member of the band Metallica, you hate this stuff. You want it to go away. Mm-hmm. If you're in the mid-level right now, which probably means you've lost your major label deal within the past year and a half, you're thinking to yourself, you know what? Anything that gets these jerks in the corner offices out of my way, I'm happy with. And if you're a little tiny indie musician who's making records and hoping that you can sell five a night in a club that holds 100 people, you're totally happy with this because you just want people to hear your stuff and you realize that without that major label deal, nobody is ever going to hear it. There's a whole complex of issues here, Tom. What's going on is that there's a lot of resentment at the industry as a whole. The industry has settled into this pattern where you can't get on commercial radio unless you're on a major label.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so there's no way for the fans to hear this stuff. I think
so. It's not yeasty. It's not getting mixed up. People aren't hearing everything they might want to hear.
Precisely. Precisely.
Randall Kennedy, what about the power of the law here? I mean, the law is powerful. And yet, Randall, we've got, Apple is trumpeting that it sold its 10 millionth song. Our guest, Wayne Russo, sitting in Nashville, looks over his shoulder. And on Grokster, he's got 750 million files being shared at that moment. I mean, is this just a techno-cultural trend that's going to run right over the law?
It might. I mean, you know, we determine what the law should be. When this many people feel that this is an okay thing to do, as people clearly do, I mean, people... you know, when people are even told that this is a wrongful thing to do, they view it as some sort of technical thing. There's no sense that this is truly immoral. So we're really in the grip of, I think, a real shift. And although the industry wants to make it seem as though we're in the grip of a disaster, mm-hmm. what I hear is opportunity.
Well, there it is. A lot of callers want to talk about it. John's calling from Lexington, Massachusetts. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah. I found Mr. Dolby's comment very interesting, that, and I just have one comment, that a few people are deciding what gets played on commercial radio or what gets heard. I may be slightly paraphrasing. And as a musician, a local musician to Boston, you think I'd be on the...
You've got a backup crew there that we can appreciate.
I'm sorry, my two-year-old daughter.
That's all right. Give it to us, John.
My point in a nutshell is the prices, though. There are like five labels, and they are, while capitalism and competition can make sure that the prices don't skyrocket, mm-hmm. well, there's only five people competing with each other, almost like they're in cahoots. So the prices of CDs are just kind of rude and high-priced, and that's my point.
Let me just ask you, John, you're a musician. Do you welcome a digital realm? Do you see how you'll make a living in a digital era?
You know, I don't, because getting a deal, I think you just got to go out and play, like one of the people commented. You just got to go out and play live to make money.
Well, John, thanks for your call. There's one generation and maybe two generations of future musicians saying that they're almost, Wayne Russell, that they're almost, John is almost walking away from the idea that he's going to make money off the sale of a physical item as a musician.
Well, you see, here's the weird thing about it, Tom. Most musicians don't, and Rick brought this up, they don't make money on the sale of the physical music or the physical item.
Mm-hmm.
They just don't. I mean, there are a few megas that'll make some money, but for the most part, the rank and file, you got to remember, these guys get these musicians, they invented stealing from musicians. Ask Little Richard. You know, they've always done this. Hey, it's no coincidence that every artist always has to audit their record label. None of my business partners ever have to audit me.
Wayne Russell, how long has Grokster been up and running on the web?
Oh, geez, we're going up about 2.5 years now.
And how many pieces of music do you think have been shared for free in that time?
Oh, Tom, I have no way of knowing. It's incomprehensible, and we physically don't have any way of.
Well, if 750 million are being shared at one moment this afternoon, does that mean billions?
Oh, no, way more.
Trillions.
Oh, I'm sure more than that.
Well, there's a website named Google. Maybe we're up in that range. Are you going to survive the transition, Wayne? Are you going to be, is Grokster here to stay, even if Universal is not?
Well, first of all, according to the U.S. federal courts, we're here to stay. We're just like a VCR sitting in your living room. So from that aspect, yes. What I've experienced, my firsthand knowledge, is that the phenomenon is growing and growing and growing. And you see, we at Grokster, we started off, we were founded with a vision of being able to enable independent artists.
Well, we hear it and we see it's working in the billions, maybe the trillions. Wayne Russell, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure, Tom. Thanks so much. And thank you, Thomas and Randall and Rick. You guys have been terrific.
Wayne Russell is president of Grokster. He joined us from Nashville, Tennessee. We're talking tonight about the online music sharing realm and the empire, the music industry striking back. What do you think? Can it win? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the online music sharing world and the empire, the music industry striking back. What do you think? Are you running scared from the music industry's online offensive this week? Are you afraid of being sued? Are the online swappers thieves? Or do they have a point of principle here? Or are they simply the future already with us? Bottom line, can the music industry reclaim its kingdom? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight by Thomas Dolby Robertson, Grammy-nominated electronic music artist, one of the very early thinkers and talkers about what would happen with the web and music. Joins us from San Mateo, California. From New York, Rick Carr, correspondent on the NPR Cultural Desk. With me in the studio, Randall Kennedy of Harvard Law School. And on the line from Appleton, Wisconsin, David's calling. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Oh, hello. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
What I wanted to do is offer a little bit of historical perspective from the media. I'm getting into the computer age in the 80s when there was software piracy, video piracy, et cetera.
Yeah.
I wanted to point out that, first of all, the youth of today is not necessarily not going out and buying music because they're just collecting it. It's like trading cards. It's like Pokemon. They're going out and it's like magic cards. They're going out. They're just collecting them just to say, I've got 10,000 of them. I've got, you know, 25 gigs of music.
So you're saying the file download is not necessarily replacing a purchase. Some people are just filling their warehouse at home just to have it.
Absolutely. And you can and basically the listeners at home can sit, take a look at their cabinet, and see it's full of VCR tapes. And each of those VCR tapes may have episodes of MASH that they have never watched in, you know, 5-10 years.
That they taped off the television for free, you're saying?
Which is technically, if they took that tape and they loaned it to their neighbor, that's technically the same copyright infringement.
But David, do you think this is going to work? If everybody's downloading gazillions of files, are we still going to have artists making a living and making great music?
But those gazillions of files, A, are not being listened to. It's rather self-important to assume that all the gazillions of files are being collected and listened to. It's also self-important to assume that that music is the music people want to listen to. They're just collecting it. And also, just to point out here that history has already spoken on this subject, that the movie industry was terrified of the VCR, did the exact same thing that's happening right now. And look, you can go out to your local Blockbuster and you can rent a VHS tape, and it's completely not copy protected. You can go out and you can buy a software game, okay, any software game, and the software protection on that is absolutely minimal from what it was 10, 15 years ago.
Yes, and yet nothing.
Those industries have made money.
Well, true, and yet nothing moves on the web quite like music. But we've got your point, David, and thanks for the call. Thomas Dolby Robinson, I want to ask you, as an artist, how do you feel? How does it make you feel to know that people are giving your work to one another and listening to it for free?
Well, you know, how would it feel if you got a message that you'd forgot to lock your front door and somebody from the neighborhood had gone into your house and taken everything and was sharing out the spoils among, you know, the people on the street? You wouldn't feel very good about it. As you know, I've always been very encouraging and very bullish about new technologies and what they could do to help musicians and help music fans. However, the fact is that if Grokster contains one of my songs...
And I'm sure
ripped,
it does.
That was ripped off a CD that I made that has a copyright notice on it saying, do not do this. Do not duplicate this music.
What a funny bind you're in, Thomas, because on the one hand, we can hear that you're a kind of techno-visionary. On the other hand, you're an artist whose music is being shipped willy-nilly all over the place without a penny coming to you, but you're sort of calmly waiting for this to coalesce around a profit-making model that will benefit for you, or have you surrendered?
I think it's very awkward that you know, back catalog material is like, it's gone. It's like you can't get the toothpaste back in the tube. There is a perfect snapshot of the world's music catalog on tens of millions of hard drives as we speak, and it's never coming back into the sort of private domain, if you like. And that's very unfortunate. But I think it's a transitionary phase, because I think that eventually the efficiency of digital distribution of music will be such that with a relatively small markup on the actual hard cost of shipping a song from point A to point B,
mm-hmm.
There will be enough of a living to be made by a new kind of music industry under a different set of technical conditions.
But it's surely going to go down fighting. A lot of these are publicly traded companies, and they want that profit. Nicholas is calling from Worcester, Massachusetts. Hi, Nicholas. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having my call.
Good to have you.
I run with some friends a music activism website called downhillbattle.org, and I guess we're hopeful that some of the changes that your guests have been talking about tonight in terms of reducing the intermediaries and getting fan support directly to the musicians that they care about will happen. But I think we're concerned that if we don't take this opportunity to really change the music industry, that these major corporations are going to find a way with reactionary lawsuits, with working through Congress, trying to buy off politicians, they're going to find a way to stay in business.
So you think the genie might yet be stuffed back in the bottle? You've got a website, downhillbattle.com, that it favors file sharing and opposes the music industry. What, on principle? Why, Nicholas?
the music industry has really stopped being useful to musicians or fans. And if you look at radio, for example, as some of the people on your show pointed out, the record labels are paying radio stations to play their music. And that means that musicians who want to have their music heard are forced to sign unfair contracts with the labels, and fans are only having access to that music. And that's how this cartel of five corporations has been able to control the music industry for so long.
Well, maybe, but what about our musician guest, Thomas W. Robertson? He's saying he feels like file sharers, which no doubt includes you, are just coming into his house and taking his furniture away.
Well, what we're saying is that we think people should go out of their way to support independent music, to support independent musicians, and we want to really, really emphasize that we think that that's the future and that's what's important here.
Nicholas, we've got it. Our time is running short, but thank you for your call. Rick Carr, what do you think that the climax or the denouement, I'm not sure where we are, what's it going to look like? Is there going to be some great battle royal still in the future? Are we in the midst of it now?
I think it's probably going to go on for a while. I mean, I think we're going to see more of this, and it is possible that there may be some legislation that comes out of Washington that slows down the process. I mean, ultimately, if I had to lay money down, I would want to quote somebody who I've interviewed a number of times, a guy named Jim Griffin, who has worked in the music industry, works out in Los Angeles for a company called Cherry Lane Digital. And he says, any time we've run into a problem like this as a society, what we end up doing is effectively sitting down in Washington and saying, let's come up with a way to sort of collectively collect the money and dole it back out. That's the way that radio works right now in terms of the way musicians get paid for when their songs are played, or the songwriters do anyway.
So you think it's going to require actually government intervention to sort it out?
Well, yeah, I think that, you know, what Jim Griffin has been talking about for a long time is an idea of like a tax basically on your internet connection that says, look, share as many files as you want for a $5 a month tax.
Mm-hmm.
And if you work the numbers through at $5 a month, it probably ends up generating more revenue than the music industry does in the United States.
There's
right
a lot
now.
To go around. It sounds like a radical solution, but we are living with a radical technology. Maybe it's what we've got coming. We are almost out of time. Rick Carr, I want to thank you very much for being with us tonight. It's just been terrific. Thanks for joining us.
Tom, you're quite welcome.
Rick Carr is culture correspondent for National Public Radio, and Thomas Dolby Robertson in San Mateo, California. It's been great having you on. Thanks so much for sharing your thoughts.
Okay, it's been fun.
And best of luck to you. I hope you get a new key on that door, or at least a new way to make money off that music. Thanks for being with us. Randall Kennedy, I mean, you called it. We've got a revolutionary technology here, and it sounds as though whatever the pushback from the industry this week, this is going places they may not want to go but may not have a choice.
A change is going to come. And I do think that Rick Carr is correct that the change is ultimately going to come through collective action. I mean, everybody's involved here, listeners, producers. This is a public issue, and it should have a public solution, namely a legislative solution.
Can you see the industry climbing into that process voluntarily?
Oh, they've got their lobbyists. They're going to be in there fighting, but they are in trouble. And the desperation of the past week underlines that.
I guess it does. It does loud and clear. So keep your heads down, folks. Storm's passing through. Randall Kennedy, thanks so much for being with us tonight. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. In a moment, Pulitzer Prize-winning author Jhumpa Lahiri. This is On Point. Jhumpa Lahiri won the Pulitzer Prize in 2000 for her collection of short stories entitled Interpreter of Maladies. The 32-year-old writer won praise for describing the immigrant experience in lyrical, detailed prose. In her first novel, The Namesake, which the New York Times described as dazzling, Lahiri follows two generations of the Gangulis family in India and then America. She talked to On Point about her own upbringing and how it influenced her work.
I'm taking quite a bit of my experience of being raised in the United States by Bengali parents in my work in Interpreter of Maladies, in the stories I was exploring, the experiences of both immigrants and their children. And similarly, in The Namesake, I think I'm looking a little bit more explicitly at questions of moving to America, putting down roots, growing up with parents who don't quite belong in the world you're living in. I definitely felt there were moments concentrated most around adolescence that I was less understanding, less tolerant of my parents and who they were and where they came from and what they represented. And I think that that's pretty much a universal experience for a lot of people, regardless of where your parents are from. That was the time in my life when I thought it was most important to fit in somehow to the world of my peers, and therefore the world of my family seemed to threaten those things in some ways or to undermine them. The book begins in 1968, and in the first section of the book, we're with one of the main characters, Ashima Ganguly, who is about to give birth in Mount Auburn Hospital in Cambridge to her first child. And then we leave off and turn to Ashok, her husband, who's in the waiting room. And he is remembering being on a train in India, going to visit his grandparents. Ashok was still reading at 2:30 in the morning, one of the few passengers on the train who was awake when the locomotive engine and seven bogies derailed from the broad gauge line. The sound was like a bomb exploding. The first four bogies capsized into a depression alongside the track. The fifth and sixth, containing the first class and air-conditioned passengers, telescoped into each other, killing the passengers in their sleep. The seventh, where Ashok was sitting, capsized as well, flung by the speed of the crash farther into the field. The accident occurred 209 kilometers from Calcutta, behind the Ghatshila and Dalbhumgarh stations. The train guard's portable phone would not work. It was only after the guard ran nearly 5 kilometers to the site of the accident, to Ghatshila, that he was able to transmit the first message for help. Over an hour passed before the rescuers arrived, bearing lanterns and shovels and axes to pry bodies from the cars. Ashok can still remember their shouts, asking if anyone was alive. He remembers trying to shout back, unsuccessfully, his mouth emitting nothing but the faintest rasp. He remembers the sound of people half dead around him, moaning and tapping on the walls of the train, whispering hoarsely for help, words that only those who were also trapped and injured could possibly hear. Blood drenched his chest and the right arm of his shirt. He had been thrust partway out the window. He remembers being unable to see anything at all. For the first hours, he thought that perhaps, like his grandfather, whom he was on his way to visit, he'd gone blind. He remembers the acrid odor of flames, the buzzing of flies, children crying, the taste of dust and blood on his tongue. They were nowhere, somewhere in a field. Milling about them were villagers, police inspectors, a few doctors. He remembers believing that he was dying, that perhaps he was already dead. He could not feel the lower half of his body, and so was unaware that the mangled limbs of Kosh were draped over his legs. Eventually he saw the cold, unfriendly blue of earliest morning, the moon and a few stars still lingering in the sky. The pages of his book, which had been tossed from his hand, fluttered in two sections a few feet away from the train. The glare from a search lantern briefly caught the pages, momentarily distracting one of the rescuers. "Nothing here," Ashok heard someone say. "Let's keep going." But the lantern's light lingered, just long enough for Ashok to raise his hand, a gesture that he believed would consume the small fragment of life left in him. He was still clutching a single page of the overcoat, crumpled tightly in his fist, and when he raised his hand, the wad of paper dropped from his fingers. "Wait," he heard a voice cry out. "The fellow by that book. I saw him move."
Jhumpa Lahiri is the author of The Namesake. For Boston listeners, Jhumpa Lahiri will read from her new novel at the First Parish Church in Cambridge, September 16th at 7 p.m. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.